Welcome to Steppin' Out, a reality radio show where you'll hear real people sharing their true stories of what it was like to go over the edge and find their way back. And now, Steppin' Out.
Yes, thank you, and welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McIntyre, your host, where week after week we hear these incredible stories of inspiration and hope, people who have turned their lives around, who have really encountered incredible adversity, as we all do, but some people more than others, and some people really transform more than others. And I'm really excited, and that's the name of the book. It's called Still So Excited, My Life as a Pointer Sister, to have Ruth Pointer with us, who is, of course, one of the Pointer Sisters. Few musical acts have ever seen the extreme highs and lows of the Pointer Sisters. They had humble beginnings in West Oakland. They endured more than 40 years under the harsh heat of the media spotlight. But their music entertained and brought joy to millions of fans around the world. But for Ruth Pointer, the journey wasn't always a happy one. And we are going to play some of their music in and out of the breaks so you all know how, remember how great they are and still are. So Ruth, welcome to Steppin' Out Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on. Well, usually every week we begin at the beginning, and I know you wrote this incredible book called Still So Excited, My Life as a Pointer Sister, and I urge everybody to read it. It's an awesome read. But tell us about your beginnings.
My beginnings, as you mentioned, were in Oakland, California. I was born and grew up in Oakland, and I have three younger sisters, and of course, in 2006, I lost my baby sister, June, and I have two older brothers. My parents were migrants from the South, and my dad was a minister and pastored the church that we attended all of our life, and my mother eventually became assistant pastor to kind of, you know, pick up the financial pace that, you know, we needed, and six kids. I'm remembering my dad made. I remember my dad making like $86 a week, and to raise six kids, you know, in Oakland, and we had a house, and we weren't on welfare, and we were not living in low housing, and I look back on it now, and those were some pretty good times.
I mean, your parents are incredible, and again, I urge you to, you know, the people out there to get the book because talk about stories of inspiration. I mean, they have another whole story within Ruth's story. But so you grew up with all these siblings and great parents and in the church, I guess, right? So was life strict for you? Were your parents strict?
It was strict, you know, according to my parents' religious, you know, rules and what they felt like they needed to do to protect us. And my mother, of course, had never been anything but a Christian all her life. She was even a minister at the age of 14, and so she knew nothing about that world outside that I so wanted to explore. And I was a big challenge for my mom. I don't know if my sisters were so much, but I know that I was, and I wanted to be like everybody else, you know. And I was constantly told that I needed to set the example for the other girls in the church and for my sisters younger than me, and I didn't like it at all. I didn't want to be the one that had to try to be perfect so that everybody else could try to be perfect, and I didn't understand, you know, what all of that meant. We weren't allowed to wear, for one while, we weren't even allowed to wear pants, and then it was no jewelry and no makeup and no dancing, and I just felt like I was being deprived. Of course, my parents, through the church, made up for a lot of that with social activities through the church, and I have to admit that a lot of those activities were fun. We always had events for Easter, like Easter egg hunts and big church picnics and Christmas programs and Easter programs and Thanksgiving programs and youth rallies and camp meetings and all sorts of activities that now I look back and I go, wow, my dad and mom, I think they were pretty brilliant now looking back, because it kept us busy and out of probably the trouble that we would have been in more than we were.
Sure.
And, you know, we always had music in the house, but it just wasn't secular music. It was patriotic music. It was country music my parents tolerated. So that's probably where that flavor came from in our own music.
Sure.
You know, as we got into professional singing.
And then, okay, so you had this, you know, pretty normal, very normal upbringing with lots of activities, which a lot of kids, like you said, your parents were ahead of their time. Mm-hmm. And then, but I read as you got older and you would want to go to parties, your father would would show up at the parties.
Yeah, my father eased up a little bit. My dad was a man who had been a man of the world, unlike my mother. Actually, my dad was 43 years old when he married my mom, and she was 17.
Oh, wow. Yeah, big
difference. Yeah. My brothers always teased my dad about that. Uh-huh. They said, "Go, Dad."
Yeah, really. And go,
you know,
Mom.
But, he had seen a little bit of the world because I think at 19 years old, my dad moved to Chicago from Arkansas, and mm-hmm. he lived a lot of his life in Chicago. And as we got older, he told us little bits and pieces about his life in the world of gambling and visiting clubs and what they call juke joints in Chicago, and it fascinated me. I was like, I wanted to be there.
You had the he's a fascinating man, your dad. Like, he's lived like a couple of lives, you know, in his, you know, years of Chicago, like you said, and then a totally different life with the church
and
the big family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what happened next in your growing up years? Like,
well, as I got older, I guess, but even my brothers, my dad loosened up. The world was changing. We were coming into the 60s when I graduated high school, and my mother, of course, never thought I'd even make it out because I was just always so mischievous and trying to do things that no one approved of. And I did. I graduated high school in Oakland, and in those days, you know, everybody was trying to get out of the house as quickly as possible.
Sure.
It fascinates me today how long kids stay at home with their parents.
Right.
You know,
till 30 almost.
Into their
yeah.
20s and 30s sometimes.
Right.
I'm like, what? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Good God. I couldn't wait to get out of that house and be on my own, you know.
That's so true, right.
I was pregnant at 18 years old, and so it was time for me to go. And I had my first daughter when I was 18, and my parents, you know, were like, well, what are you going to do, and what is this guy going to do, and confronted us both, and we felt like we had to marry. So I married this guy that I hardly knew, mm-hmm. and right after I had my daughter, Fawn, I was pregnant again. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost as if, I mean, marriage, I guess back then was almost just like it was a license to be able to have sex legally. Because
true.
There was no abortion or anything. So, you know,
right.
you're married so you could have sex.
And, mm-hmm.
And
when you're young, you're really fertile, let's face it. You know.
Yeah, when you're young, you're really fertile and you have babies. And that's what happened to me. I was, you know, I had two children when I was 19 years old. And I didn't have a clue what to do with them.
You know, this woman who we're talking to might have seemed like she had it all because she was a famous singer in a famous band with huge success. But life isn't always easy. It has extreme highs and lows, and that's what happened to who I'm talking to. She had extreme highs and lows, and you can read about it in her book, Still So Excited, My Life as a Pointer Sister. And I have the honor of speaking to Ruth Pointer, and right before the break, she was telling us she got married, and by 19, she had two kids, which is, you know, a lot to handle. So then what happened?
Well, you know, even up until that time, my sisters and I were already singing together as the Pointer Sisters in my dad's church. And it was just something we just did. You know, it wasn't a big deal to us. We saw another family up the street from our house that were doing that, and we just copied off of them and thought, okay, well, let's do that. And it was fun, and it was, you know, something we really did naturally because we had perfect training in the choir to know how to blend and make a harmony, and it was just something that we learned and did almost instinctively. And so that was already in place. The two kids came, and I really didn't know how to parent or be a companion to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And neither did my first husband. And it was just a complete disaster. And I was domestically abused and didn't know which way to continue my life. So I ended up going back home, and by that time my sisters were singing together as a couple called Pointers, a pair, and that was Bonnie and June.
Mm-hmm.
Anita had had a child in between that and had married, but that didn't work out for her either, so she decided to join Bonnie and June, and they became the Pointer Sisters. And I later joined them.
Mm-hmm.
During all this time, I have since become a product of being in recovery, have learned that during all those years, even while I was in high school, I was always concerned about my appearance and my body image.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would periodically go on a diet, and she would have diet pills around the house that the doctor gave her to take to curb her appetite, and no one thought a big deal of it. And when I would tell her I wanted to lose a few pounds, she'd say, "Oh, I got those pills, so you're welcome to take them if you want."
Mm-hmm.
The doctor prescribed them, so they should be fine. And I would take these diet pills and love the way they made me feel.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to me that it was speed.
Right.
Never occurred to me that I was developing a addiction of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never even heard that word.
Sure.
And I just took them to curb my appetite so I wouldn't eat. And as I got older and got into a different social circle, I learned about things like cocaine and speed and heroin. And people started telling me things about these substances that they weren't dangerous. And we're talking about the 60s, late 60s and early 70s. And there was even a publication at the time that said that cocaine was no more dangerous than a glass of milk. And I, being my thought I had been deprived self, decided I wanted to be like, the hippies on a Haight-Ashbury and in San Francisco, and started indulging in all these substances, alcohol, marijuana, and all kinds of acid and cocaine, and just thought I was having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody else, and never occurred to me I was developing any kind of an addiction. There wasn't a lot of talk about the danger of these substances. It was just everybody was sort of doing it and participating, and we were just having the best time with new music coming into the scene with Bay Area music, with Sly and the Family Stones and Tower Power and Herbie Hancock and Cold Blood and Sylvester, and Motown was raging at the time with the Supremes and Marvin Gaye and Isley Brothers and Temptations and Four Tops, and I was just mesmerized by all this wonderfulness of how I felt with the help of these substances.
Right.
In a black light and sitting on a floor with pillows and wonderful music, and I just thought it was heaven. And as time goes on, I become a new member of the group, and started going on the road. And mind you, I've got these two children hanging, onto my mother's apron strings. God bless her. She just took the reins and took over the children, because I at one point had said, "Mom, I don't know what to do with them. I'm going to give them up for adoption. I can't. And she said, "No, honey, you can't do that. I won't let you. And I'll keep one of them, and one of them maybe have to go to your husband's family." And that's what we did. My son went to my husband's family. My mother kept my oldest daughter. And I went on the road. By this time, I was in my second marriage, and that didn't last very long, because he really didn't expect me to become who I became. And I think somewhere the egos got kind of twisted, and I was on the road enjoying myself and building a new career and wanted to take every advantage of it, and got involved in another relationship while on the road, and things just kept evolving. Sort of, I felt like I was just on a moving train that wasn't going to stop, you know. We were really, really busy a lot. Big bus tours and all over the world, and being, you know, successful like we hadn't imagined. And I was sending money home and visiting home once in a while, and I thought that was enough. You know, since I've had my later children and became sober in the last 30 years, I've been made so much more aware of the things that a parent needs to do. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I was just thinking about it this morning because I have a 22-year-old son here at home in his senior year in college, but he still wakes up in the morning and wants me to fix him breakfast. Mm-hmm. He comes in the evening and goes, Mom, what's to eat?
You right.
know? And I think about the things that I did not do for my older children. Little things like that, and I was talking to my mother-in-law about it yesterday. I said, I don't even know if it's that he really wants me to fix his breakfast. I think it's just the intimacy with me he wants.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, Mom's here. I want her to do my food.
And there's that connection,
attention.
Right? And it, yeah.
And I just like it. It wrecks me inside, and I just fold. Okay.
Well, moms of sons especially, they kind of can have them wrapped around your finger. But you were just a child yourself, you know, a child having a child.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know, what did you know? Like you said, you were 18. I mean, kids 18 now, I can't imagine, or 19, I can't imagine, you know, 99.99% of any kid that age could handle it. So you were no different. But we're going to come back and find out the rest of your incredible story. I'm Denise McEntee, your host of Stepping Out Radio, talking to the great Ruth Pointer of the Pointer Sisters. And we're talking about her book. It's called Still So Excited, My Life as a Pointer Sister. And I really urge everybody to get it. It's really quite a read and quite a story. And to hear this, you know, everything you went through, and now you have this sense and sound in your voice even of peace. It's so, you know, such a tremendous gift that you worked on, and we're going to hear more about how you worked on yourself. You're listening to Stepping Out. Ruth was telling us that she went on the road and had this incredible life, but her children were left behind, and you were talking about how now with your son, who's 22, how different it is. But what happened next, you know, during the heydays, and then what brought you to finally come to the realization that you needed help and you transformed your life?
You know, I started to have moments of clarity because I started to see my children, especially the two older ones, following in my footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And my son in particular turned my life around when he went to get help through a 12-step program, and he invited me to come along with him, and at that time I didn't want to do it because I just felt like it was a shame thing of admitting that you weren't perfect, God forbid. And I went and got involved in a recovery program through Scientology called Dianetics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Narconon, and it worked for me for a while, but it really was expensive. And I even brought my two older children into that program with me, and I spent a lot of money, thousands and thousands of dollars.
Wow.
But the thing it did for me was it did start to clear the smoke in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the clearer that smoke went, I started to see my finances going down.
Mm.
And I thought, you know what? AA is kind of looking kind of good right now. That's
12 pass the hat around.
It's free.
Well, you pass the hat around, but yeah, no, it's so true.
You know what I mean? I'm like, ooh, yes, I think I'll go sit in one of those meetings and tell my story to somebody, you know. But
right.
And that's what I started doing with the help of my son, Malik, who still is in Los Angeles, and he's a big part of the 12-step program there.
And how cool is that, though? For, you know, you don't hear that much, even on this show, and we do these stories. But how cool that your son got you. You know.
Yeah.
That's cool. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So
that's okay. But you know, we got involved together and started that road of recovery, and that was the turning point for me, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That, along with a few years later, I was sick with meningitis and on the road, and because I went back out into the drug world, and because I couldn't control my food,
mm-hmm.
and I have learned that is really my major addiction is food.
And sugar,
right? I know that people don't want to think of food as a drug, but it is.
Oh, yeah, sugar, too.
And it will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And I, along with so many other people, will do anything to not be fat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see this in our society every day with people going under the knife and doing all kinds of suctions and diet business is a billion-trillion-dollar business, and you know, women don't want to look bad,
right?
Or what they consider bad.
Sure.
I mean, I know that I have body dysmorphia. I know I do. I look at myself in the mirror and I see little pockets of this and that here and there. But anyway, that was my issue, and once I kind of started to see that was my issue, I sought out ways to get a handle on that problem so that I wouldn't go back into the drug world.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for me. I found a 12-step program that dealt with food addiction,
mm-hmm.
and it enabled me to be able to organize my life around the food and not have to depend on substances to control my eating.
Hmm.
And it has saved my life. I've been a part of this program for almost 15 years. It's been an eye-opening experience. I, a few years ago, had another experience with a blood clot in my lung from traveling and just sitting on planes,
mm-hmm.
all those years. They said it probably traveled from my legs. I have to now wear support hose on a plane, get up and walk the aisle a couple of times if it's more than a five-hour flight.
Right.
I'm learning to take care of myself is what it boils down to.
Sure. And does this program help you maintain your weight? Like, is
weigh and measure everything that goes in my mouth.
Good for you.
And I eat 3 meals a day. No exceptions. I don't care where I am, who's around. And if it's not conducive to the way I eat, then I don't participate. I mean, there are sometimes restaurants and places that people invite me to go, and I have to decline. I say, I'm sorry, not for me.
Right.
You
can't get anything healthy. Right.
Yeah, I've gone to events where they're offering food, and I have to say, no, thank you. No, I have a certain way of eating. It's not here. I don't see what I need for myself here. I'll have to wait, or I'll eat before I go to an event. Whatever it takes.
So by changing your food, because this is so interesting, it took away like maybe all the crave. Well,
absolutely.
Wow. See?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Because a big part of a lot of people, too, when they come on, they realize the same thing as you did. You know, they might be alcoholic, but a lot of it, like you said, is the sugar. And when they put the alcohol down, boy, you know, then the sugar comes into it. And
right,
even at the
exactly.
meetings, it's like, well, it used to be, you know, the cookies, the donuts, the coffee with the sugar, so this is interesting. So what's your life like now? Like
my life is fabulous now.
Good.
I'm proud of where I am now. I've worked very hard to get here. Actually, when I get off this phone, I'm going to a meeting, one of my food my food meetings.
Good.
In Watertown.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it, and I've been going for almost 15 years. And there are other, you know, groups around town in Cambridge and different places. And it keeps me grounded, and I'm still on the road periodically, not like we used to be, but we do have a tour coming up in May and June in Australia.
Yes, and I wanted to say that also, in addition to promoting the book, and I urge you again to get it, called Still So Excited, My Life as a Pointer Sister. If you want to find out about the Pointer Sisters tours and anything about the Pointer Sisters, you can go to their website at www.pointersisters.com. ThePointerSisters.com. So you're going to Australia. Well, now that's a long flight. You're going to have to.
That's a long one.
Yeah. You're going to have to get up for sure. So you tour like maybe a couple of times a year?
Well, we don't tour like we used to. We still go on. We still have engagements, but they're sporadic. Like a lot of the casinos that have popped up, you know, we do those, you know, the Indian casinos and in different areas. We do those. We do corporate events,
sure.
Private parties. That's my audience, you know. We're now those people.
Yeah.
And so we do a lot of corporate events, private parties, basically that's fine for me.
That's great. And now, I know, and I'm sorry about this, I know one of your sisters passed away. Am I right about that?
Yes, June. Yes,
right.
She passed away in 2006.
So is it just the three of you now, or...?
You know, and my sister Anita has had some health issues, and so she's on a medical leave right now. My sister Bonnie has been a solo artist since 1976.
Yeah, I read
that.
And
she still
is. Uh-huh.
And so now I've pulled in my daughter, Issa.
Great. Oh, wow.
Whom I was pregnant, 8 months pregnant on the road with back in 1978.
Cool.
And my granddaughter, Sadako.
Oh, wow.
Who is
so it's really
my
full circle.
Daughter. So we have a great time on the road. You know, I'm the last sister standing on the stage, and I'm loving having my family there with me.
That's great. How nice is that? Well, you've been a pleasure to talk to. I really, really appreciate your coming on. And again, I'm going to urge everybody to get the book.
Thank you.
Especially, I think it's really important for people to hear that connection, too, that you said with the food, because I think 80% of the people I know have some, like you said, especially women, obsession with their weight, and it's probably even higher than 80%. You know, it's like...
And
if only...
men, too. I mean, you know, I don't know why no one wants to talk about that, but it's real.
Right. Well, now it's really real. You
it's
know,
really it's, real, you
it's,
know?
It's every... It's just everywhere. It's pervasive.
Yeah.
It really is. But I urge you to go out again and get the book. Still so excited. My Life as a Pointer Sister. We've been talking to Ruth Pointer. And what would be the one last thing you'd say to somebody out there maybe struggling with a problem?
With a substance problem?
Yeah, with a substance problem.
I would just say try and get some help. You know, there are different ways for different people depending on what your issues are.
Sure.
I don't believe there's one way to do it, you know. People do it in different ways. I've seen people in recovery from all different types of, you know, recovery places and helps and whatever it takes for you. If you really want to do it, you first got to admit you got a problem. You know, a lot of people don't want to even realize that they have a problem.
Nobody does. It's too hard. But
you know,
again,
no one wants to be imperfect, but we're all imperfect.
Well, you're coming close to perfect with your life now. So thank you, Ruth Pointer. And again, I urge everybody to go to our website and hear more stories like these at steppingoutradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time when we all go stepping out. Thanks, everybody.
All right.